So today my goal is to finish Song of Solomon, and then we're also going to have some of you volunteer to give your reports today, which is really good. That'll give us a little more elbow room to get everyone else's done tomorrow. So let's turn back to chapter 5 of Song of Solomon. We've been through courtship with the beloved and the Shulamite. And then we saw the wedding procession. Wasn't it a beautiful wedding? Anybody cry? No? Okay. I'm having fun with you. Just a little review here. Wow, wasn't that a wedding feast? 7 days. Woo! I don't know if people do that much. And I know not in our Western culture so much. I think it's still practiced in some of the cultures in the Middle East. And then, of course, the wedding night. And we should all blush a little bit because we're kind of eavesdropping, so to speak, on something very beautiful and very wonderful. And I just can't stress enough how Scripture, God's point of view of marriage and of the reason He created sex, it's to be enjoyed in marriage between a husband and wife. And of course, it's there to have children, to create family, but it is also there as to be a delight. Something very beautiful and wonderful between a husband and wife. I'm not going to go into the contrast so much, but it's much different than what society continues to do with sexuality and making it rather sordid, kind of a grimy sort of thing. And that's not at all what God intended. So it's really sad if we don't understand what God intended, and we've come to a point of understanding through Scripture. God has to reveal these things to us. That the beauty of marriage and of husband and wife, that relationship to becoming one under the blessing and guidance of God, is a very beautiful thing. And that too is one of the things that sets us apart from animals. And sadly, it seems that humanity is becoming more animalistic in many different ways in its relationship with other human beings. And it's a rather disturbing thing. And of course, the thing we have to be cautious about, we have to be careful of living in the world but not a part of it. We have to be very much on our guard to not allow the world's approach to marriage, to sexuality, pull us down, you might say, to their level. It is a beautiful thing. It is part of what makes us like God. It's a divinely ordained thing, marriage, and the beauty of marriage. So it's very important for us as Christians to have a right respect for marriage, not to treat it as something common, but to revere it, to honor one another, husband and wives, to honor one another and love one another. And so then we moved into chapter 5. I told you there's this phrase that appears 4 times. It's the phrase, my sister, my spouse. And I didn't get a chance to explain that yesterday. I'll do that now. And I think I pointed out to you that phrase is repeated 4 times in verse 9, and then in verse 10, verse 12, and then in chapter 5, verse 1. Each of these scholars have studied, and it seems to represent, some claim, 4 stages of the lovemaking of that special night, consummation of their marriage. Now, the phrase itself can sound disturbing. My sister, my spouse, what is that all about? It's a term of endearment, actually. In that culture, it was a term of endearment. By marriage, it's emphasizing that they are related now, by marriage. They are family, in one sense. And I've never heard anybody in my family call anybody a sister except that was really a sister. Now, of course, in the church, we talk about my brother and my sister, spiritually speaking, of course. But this is a term of endearment, and there's nothing creepy. There's nothing incestuous at all about this. Just my sister and now my spouse, they're related by marriage. They're very much part of the family in a very real way. The closest female relative a man could have is his sister, okay? So I guess that's part of their cultural background. You can look up more about it, but that seems to be the sense of that. That's something we do not retain in our culture, but is something that was expressed in ancient times. So Let's go on then, chapter 5. Let's pick it up. We've seen this in the New King James at the end of verse 1. New King James, you notice they put in parentheses, to his friends, these last three lines, eat, O friends, drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones. They think suddenly he's saying to his friends, my buddies, hey, you all need to get married. This is great, get married. But you notice how they put it in parentheses, to his friends, at least it is in my edition. Others, is that what it is in your edition too? That gives you a sense. Scholars really don't know what to do with those three lines. And so what I've been reading, it seems to be a growing conclusion that perhaps this is an implicit, meaning implied reference or appearance of God. God, in one sense, does not overtly insert himself into the story. We don't have a lot of direct references. I'm trying to think. I don't know if there are any direct references to God, per se. Which seems odd, but when you think about it, these three lines would make sense. I mean, who would be watching this consummation of marriage? Who would be talking to these beloved ones? I think this voice is speaking to the new husband and new wife. I think, like other scholars, it's likely God. God created marriage and he's blessing it. And he's encouraging them in their love for one another. Then we shift to something quite different. Here's another shift. As I mentioned to you, the poem kind of jumps. It skips from one image to another. And here's another one, that quite different scene. This occurs from verses 2 through 8 of chapter 5. And most scholars try to explain it off as another dream sequence. She had some troublesome dreams during the courtship period before they got married. And of course, we would think, having been brought up with a lot of romantic ideas in our culture, that once you're married, it's just, life is just a piece of cake, perfect, no more fears, no more worries, no more concern about yourself and your spouse. It's just going to be, what do we call that? An everlasting honeymoon? You ever hear about a honeymoon? It's like, oh, it's so wonderful. And it is great, don't get me wrong. But you also heard about how the honeymoon ends. Any of you old married people, has your honeymoon ended yet? Don't answer that. It continues on, just a few different notes thrown in perhaps. So we get the idea, oh, you're married. If you watch a lot of Hallmark movies, you just think, oh, they lived happily ever after, just like Cinderella and all the other princesses Walt Disney keeps creating. That's not quite the way it goes. This is a rather realistic view of what happens in marriage. It seems, apparently, something has happened. She either is dreaming, she's dreaming that they've had a tiff, a fight of some sort, or that he has walked out on her, or she's walked out on him, or this actually happened, perhaps. They're really not sure what's going on here. But when it says, I sleep, she starts in verse 2. That's what makes everybody, it seems, think this is a dream sequence. Something has happened in these very early stages of their marriage. I sleep, but my heart is awake. It is the voice of my beloved. So maybe she's dreaming this is happening. He knocks, saying, open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is covered with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. It seems like he's locked out. He's locked out of the house or something. We don't quite understand, and it's cold and wet outside. And she says, verse 3, to herself, I've taken off my robe. How can I put it on again? Sounds like she's already gotten ready for bed. She's in bed. I have washed my feet. How can I defile them? How can I muddy them? My beloved put his hand by the latch of the door, and my heart yearned for him. And so sounds like she didn't want to let him in. But then I arose to open for him my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh. Is that a reference of love and all this? We don't know. My fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the lock. I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone. And my heart leaped up when he spoke, but I sought him and I could not find him. I called him, but he gave no answer. So again, is this a dream sequence filled with a lot of anxiety? You know, kind of psychological turmoil going on as they adjust to each other? We don't know. But verse 7 sounds odd. If this were real, it sounds much more likely, again, if this happened in a dream, because she went out to look for him. Verse 7, she says, the watchmen who went about the city found me and they struck me and wounded me. Well, they really do that in real life? It's hard to know. It doesn't seem quite right. The keepers of the walls took my veil away from me. And so she's gone out searching the city until the watchmen catch her wandering around at night and knocked her about a bit. It's really unclear what's happening. Most scholars are just kind of befuddled by this. They're not sure. And so that's why they think it may be a dream sequence. Maybe her subconscious is fretting over her new lifestyle and marriage. There's a lot of adjustment period. And frankly, in marriage, there are going to be spats. After all, you are two different personalities becoming one. That doesn't always happen very smoothly. There's going to be a little friction along the way. Perhaps that's what this reveals to. Then in verse 8, the Shulamite, as she has done before, when there's been some kind of conflict, whether it's actual or psychological, internal, whatever, she will address the daughters of Jerusalem. She addresses other young maidens. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him, I am lovesick. So apparently, if this is still in the dream, she wants others to know, if they see him, that she wants him. She hasn't rejected him. She doesn't want him to think that she doesn't want him. You know, she's not rejecting him. Then we have another shift. Again, it seems to be a leap to another, some would say another poem, but it's another image. Here we're setting up another wasp that's going to appear. Now the question is from the daughters of Jerusalem, and they're addressing the Shulamite. What is your beloved more than another beloved, O fairest of women? In other words, they seem to be asking, they repeat the question, what is your beloved more than another love? It seems to be suggesting, well, what makes your man so special? What makes your beloved so much different than anybody else's beloved? And so it's setting up an opportunity for her to kind of do the little bragging here about her spouse, her beloved now. They are married. This time we get a wasp, this descriptive poem. Remember, how do we spell that? W-A-S-F. W-A-S-F, and it's pronounced wasp. Here we get a wasp, a descriptive poem of her beloved physical beauty. She's describing him this time. Notice how she begins, my beloved. Is she staking claims? Oh yeah, she's putting up the protective fences here. This is my man. Just so you all people out there, you want to make sure beloved better? He's mine, first of all. My beloved is white and ruddy. So he's got a light complexion. He's got rosy cheeks. He's healthy. In other words, he's healthy. He's chief among 10,000. So he's unlike most other men. This is her opinion. His head is like the finest gold. That's not an unusual description in ancient times to describe someone with a head of gold. It seems like there's a statue described in the Bible somewhere about a head of gold. It's description saying the person is most excellent, regal, the highest possible value. And of course, the head, the face, the brain, all right there. His head is like the finest gold. His locks are wavy and black as a raven. So he has this beautiful black, shiny hair, okay? His eyes are like doves. Oh, her eyes are like doves, and so are his. It must be very warm and gentle, beautiful. His eyes are like doves, but by the rivers of waters. Well, that might suggest that his eyes are gentle and comforting, but by the rivers of waters, it gives you more the idea that his eyes must have a little sparkle in them. Maybe they're full of life. And oftentimes we're talking about how people, their eyes sparkle. There's something in there going on. It's something very attractive we like. They're washed with milk and fitly set. His cheeks are like a bed of spices, banked of scented herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. You notice a lot of these references sound like part of the description of the garden we read about in the marriage night. That same garden quality is about her beloved. His hands are rods of gold, verse 14, set in beryl. They're strong. They're strong hands, both strong and yet beautiful. His body is carved ivory inlaid with sapphires. Well, he's beautiful. He's beautiful. And we get this sense of body carved with ivory. Most scholars recognize this probably as reference to his muscular, smooth skin, beautiful to behold. And again, she's describing him again from the top down, which is tradition, just as he had described her on their wedding night from top down. We're working our way down to the legs. Verse 15, his legs are pillars of marble set on bases of fine gold. So she's using the most precious materials to describe her love. These materials, as compared to his description for her, these materials are known for having a certain strength, aren't they? They have a hardness to them, but yet they're described in such a way there's also the softness about him. She's not describing him like a block of granite, okay? He's strong, but then there's softness. There's something gentle about his beauty as well. His countenance is like Lebanon, excellent as the cedars, the cedar trees. His countenance, in other words, the way he stands, his expression of face, seems to be this like the mountains of Lebanon, like the cedar trees. They're majestic. There's a strength in them. There's a beauty there. His mouth is most sweet. Yes, he is altogether, everything about him is lovely. And then notice how she ends verse 16. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Is she being rather possessive here? She better be. Just like you better be possessive of your spouse. And you have every right to be possessive, and so does she. This is her husband, and she loves him. Notice that she calls him her friend. Friend was not a word used, apparently friend was not a word used lightly back in those times. We tend to use friend for just about anybody. How many Facebook friends do you have? People brag, oh, I got thousands of friends. They friended me. And I'm going to unfriend you. That's really cold, but that happens too. Friend back then seems to be something a little more limited to just certain special people. Her friend means he is her companion. And what this does is it stresses not just a sexual relationship they have in marriage, but something much more. There's something going beyond the marital relationship, the sexual relationship per se. There is a bond now. There is a bond in the relationship, this idea of companionship that's developing. Her love for him is a jealous love, is what she's beginning to show us. And rightly so. Continuing on, chapter 6, the daughters of Jerusalem say, well, where has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Where has your beloved turned aside that we may seek him with you? So again, now it seems to be picking up this idea that, well, he's not with you. Can we go find him? The women, are these her friends, are enthusiastic about trying to help her find him wherever he's at? Or perhaps better, this just may be a rhetorical question in a poem. It's not meant literally, but it gives her, again, a chance to explain where her beloved is. Maybe they're saying, we don't see your husband around town as much as we used to. And maybe they're playfully saying, well, where has he gone? You know, we know you're married, but where's your husband? I don't see him much. Verse 2 through 3, in response, in many ways, she seems to be telling them, well, frankly, it's none of your business, but if you need to know, he's with me. He's mine. My beloved has gone to his garden. Remember who his garden is? Her. To the beds of spices, to feed his flock in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He feeds his flock, or he feeds among the lilies. In other words, he is mine, and I am his, and he's not available to anybody else. And you need to quit looking for him. That's how I could read this, you know. Staking her claim, making very clear. And so again, we get an insight to marriage. There's this adjustment that's going on between the two of them. And then there's also this adjustment that's going on with the married couple in the larger society around them. Newlyweds get teased a lot, frankly. And the daughters of Jerusalem, or these are other her unmarried friends, maybe they're wanting her to do a little, some of this little kissing and telling. She's not telling. And you really shouldn't. That's between you and your spouse. It's a very private thing. We move on to verse 4. Here's another shift of scene. And this scene, again, it jumps. It's another jump. it's another wask. This time it's the husband. It's beloved now. Another shift of scene, and now he is praising his wife. She is his wife with another wask. Here we find that she is somewhat like a city, and she's royal, and she's become more powerful. And what we describe, what we might see this wask from the other, they're not exactly the same as the one we saw of her earlier. She seems to be described with a little bit more regal bearing, as if she, yes, she was a woman, but now she has become more of a woman somehow, and since marriage, and something is changing about her, and she's becoming even more beautiful. He says, verse 4, "Oh, my love, you're as beautiful as Tirzah, one of the main cities in the northern part of the kingdom of Israel. Lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners." He says, verse 5, "Turn your eyes away from me, for they have overcome me." So it's like her eyes overpower him. Her eye, just a look of her eyes conquers him, takes him like an army. "Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Gilead." Yep, her hair is still the same. He loves her hair, obviously. She says this beautiful smile. "Your teeth are like a flock of sheep which have come up from the washing." Everyone bears twins. Okay, she hasn't lost any yet. "And none is barren among them." And so he's repeating this beautiful description. Well, he still adores her. He still finds her drop-dead gorgeous. "Like a piece of pomegranate are the temples behind your veil." Verse 8 is a little different, and the meaning here is obscure. He says, "There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number." But then he seems to be setting up this comparison, because in verse 9, he makes a point that she is better than all of them. Now, do we take this literally suddenly, or people wonder, well, is this Solomon talking about his 60 other wives and 80 concubines and other women he has, like this is Solomon before he ended up with the 700 wives and 300 concubines. I think I got the right order. So is this when he was still building his harem? I don't know. I really don't know, and scholars are unsure. It could be that some argue maybe he's just talking about queens and concubines from other surrounding nations or something, or maybe it's just a hyperbole that we're not supposed to be taken literally. We really don't know, and I'm not sure either. I could see it either way, possibly. But the point is, he's making a contrast with all these other regal, beautiful women, virgins, young girls. He says, "My dove," now so he's possessive, "my dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her. The daughter saw her," could be the daughters of Jerusalem and these other maidens, "and called her blessed. The queens and the concubines apparently saw her, and they praised her. Who is she who looks forth as the morning, who is beautiful as the morning light?" That's a popular image of poetry even to this day. She's as beautiful as the noonday sun, you know. "Fair as the moon, clear as the sun, awesome as an army of banners." Well, he just said, well, who is she? We know it's his wife. Very clear. More beautiful. She's more beautiful, more precious than before. She has been transformed by love and marriage. She has become even more awesome to him, more radiant and more happy. Marriage, love does something. Another shift of scene begins to occur. And suddenly, the remainder of the book, we find this kind of skipping, shifting of scenes. And we're getting, you're going to be hearing me say this a lot, we come to have more and more obscure things going on. We're not quite sure what's happening. Verses 11 through 12 is another obscure scene then. We think it's the Shulamite. Some aren't sure. Maybe it's the man speaking. It's either the woman or man. We're not sure. "I went down to the Garden of Nuts." Could be almond garden, almond orchard, quite possibly. Nuts is just for any kind of fruit tree in some ways. "I went down to the Garden of Nuts to see the verdure, the beautiful growing agriculture of the valley, the woods, all that, to see whether the vine had budded and the pomegranates had bloomed. Before I was even aware, my soul had made me as the chariots of my noble people." It could be a reference maybe back to their, kind of like the garden scene again, the marriage, that maybe some sexual connotation here in marriage again, maybe talking about the budding, the blooming of their loving relationship. Verse 12, scholars agree this is one of the most enigmatic verses of the book. Before I was even aware, my soul had made me as the chariots of my noble people. I guess it would kind of tie in about the transforming nature of marriage. I guess that is something we might draw from that. Verse 13, this would be the beloved, apparently speaking. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you, perhaps the beloved and his friends. And what would you see in the Shulamite? As it were, the dance of the two camps. Verse 13, I have in big letters here in my notes, very obscure. They're not sure what this is. Perhaps the dance of the two camps, that's a kind of literal translation of the word Mahanaim. It's a place over near Gilead. Maybe they've gone to some kind of agricultural festival of some sort. They suggest maybe she's dancing to please her husband and his many friends or something. Maybe some kind of belly dancing, or I don't know if that would be quite right, but that's what some scholars suggest. We're not sure. Verse 7, another wask of the man describing his wife, describing the woman, his wife. Again, head to toe. There's some differences here in what we found. Some say perhaps he's describing her as she dances before him. How beautiful are your feet in sandal, O prince's daughter. Here, prince's daughter, you know, is that a reference to Solomon marrying a king's daughter? Or could it be another reference to the husband calling his wife his princess, his queen? We're not sure. Notice the description now is a little bit different what we've seen of her before. The curves of your thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a skillful workman. Your navel is a rounded goblet. Again, if you start reading this literally, it sounds, okay, yeah, okay, this is funny. The next line is really funny. Don't take this literally. Your navel is a rounded goblet. It lacks no blended beverage here. Your waist is a heap of wheat set about with lilies. Most women nowadays would not want their waist described as a heap of wheat. Okay, you know, think of a couple bags of flour around your waist. Okay, that's not very flattering, at least not where I come from. But it is flattering. Here's why I say that. What he is actually describing is she is voluptuous. She's not a beanpole. That makes sense? She's not anorexic. How about that? Okay. Back in ancient culture, a woman was beautiful if she, no offense here, if a woman had wide hips, that was part of her beauty. Part of what men looked for was a woman that would be able to be strong physically, have the right body type so that she would be able to deliver lots of babies. Okay? I hate to say it that way, but you'll find the same references made even up in Europe into the Middle Ages, into 1900s. That was a sign of beauty. In our culture, we're shifting away from that in many ways, and beauty in much of our culture today is thinner is better. But in this ancient time, to have a waist is like a heap of wheat, your voluptuous curves, that was very much considered a thing of beauty. Your two breasts are like fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes like the pools in Heshbon. Her eyes deep and dark, maybe suggesting that her eyes are more rich. There's more wisdom or depth of love or something in your eyes. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon, which looks towards Damascus. Yeah, some scholars actually say, well, maybe she did have a large nose, you know? Okay, some people do. That's no big deal. Some have teeny little noses. Some have big noses. I have a big nose, but I don't think about it. Anyway, the nose is like a Tower of Lebanon. It's really talking about her majestic features of her face. She's very beautiful. Grandeur. Tower of Lebanon maybe was made of limestone towers, probably very this sort of a building seen from afar that was bright and light colored. Maybe he's referring to the color of her skin. We don't know. Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel, and the hair of your head is like purple. Well, okay, they didn't dye the sheep or the goats. The hair of your head is like purple. Regal is what he's talking about. Not so much the color, but the meaning of the color purple is the color of royalty. Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel. Her hair is her glory. Her hair is very beautiful. And what's really incredible about her hair, a king is held captive by your tresses. He feels he is held captive. He's definitely in her control, you might say, by her beauty. But the looking into the eyes seemed to suggest it goes far beyond physical beauty. In other words, we could say he feels the same for her as he did before, but a little bit more. And what we notice is her description has more of these regal features, suggesting very much she is definitely like a queen to him, like a princess. And of course, as her husband, he is definitely her prince, her king. And so we get that meaning. How fair and how pleasant you are, O beloved, with your delights, the stature, and here it gets a little funny, and I don't know. The stature of yours is like a palm tree, and your breast like its clusters. Talking about date palms. That's where you get dates, the fruit. And the stature of yours is like a palm tree, and your breast like its clusters. I said, this is her husband, I will go up to the palm tree, I will take hold of its branches. Let now your breasts be like clusters of the vine, grapevine, and the fragrance of your breath like apples, and the roof of your mouth like the best wine. This is rather provocative. This description is metaphor, figurative, but it's very much, there's sexual meanings here. One of the, one of the scholars said, not trying to be too blunt here, in essence, he's saying, she's a beautiful tree and he wants to climb her tree. And he can. They're married, okay? And of course, we might, part of what our society does, our society is really interesting. On one hand, it makes sex so obvious and so, you know, like hitting you over the head. And then on the other hand, it can be so prudish about things. You know what I mean? Like, oh, we can't talk about that. And so we kind of have this nervous giggle. But it's not quite that way in the Bible. It's sexuality is talked about, but it's talked about with these beautiful images, but yet not necessarily with as if it's some secret we should never talk about. You can believe me when I say children back then knew where babies came from. Okay? And that's good. When I was a kid, people still thought babies came from under the cabbage leaf. What do you think they called them? Cabbage Patch Kids. Those little dolls. Or the stork brought them. We created all these stupid myths. And instead, just having a good conversation with their children, well, you know, appropriately so. But yeah, that's where babies come from. They're married. If he wants to climb her tree, he can. They're married. In verse 10 ends it again. I am my beloved, and his desire is toward me. Again and again, they're possessive. This is a possessive love that two people should have for one another in marriage. Verse 11, come, my beloved, let's go to the fields, let us lodge in villages. Seems to suggest now we've shifted scenes. We're no longer in the city, of course. We're out in the country. Some scholars suggest, well, maybe this is a reference to their part of their honeymoon trip. Maybe they're going out in the country, visiting her. It's nice to get away from the city. In the city, there's too many prying eyes. Most times when we have honeymoons, we to this day, we'll go out to some resort somewhere. We'll go someplace away from all our friends and family, and where we can just have time together. Because once everyday life begins, you're not going to have as many opportunities for those special nights and times alone. So it suggests that they've gone to the country. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine has budded, whether grape blossoms are opened, pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. And so they're talking about going back to the countryside. Verse 13, the mandrakes give off a fragrance. Mandrakes were a root. They're aphrodisiac, traditionally, is how people see it, a sexual stimulant. At our gates are pleasant fruits, all manner new and old, which I've laid up for you, my beloved. And so, again, here's all this imagery. It's again, the imagery of a kind of a secret garden that they now share together. The innuendo, the metaphor is all there.
They are a young couple, very much in love, and very much in the honeymoon state. And the emphasis, which I think we get through here, is that marriage is not a one-night stand. It's a long-term thing. But it has to be built. When we get married, we just don't stay happily married without some good effort. And it takes work. My wife and I try to have date nights, you know, get away from the kids. And it's hard. Life takes over sometimes, and it's hard to carve out time. But it's something you do. And I think that's part of what we're beginning to see here. They had the joy of the marriage night and so on, but there's ups and downs. There's still this time of adjustment. It's for life. It's not for until we get tired of each other. Marriage is a lifelong commitment. Chapter 8, we get to the end. A lot of obscure things here. It seems to be they've gone back to the wife's, the beloved's, the Shulamite's home, perhaps visiting her family. Verse 1-2, "Oh, that you are like my brother," she says to her husband, "who nursed at my mother's breast." And this seems kind of weird, but there's a good explanation for it. "If I should find you outside, I would kiss you, and I would not be despised. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother." Kind of the idea she could hold him by the hand and walk him around and bring him in the house of her mother, "she who used to instruct me. I would cause you to drink of spiced wine of the juice of my pomegranate." Well, this sounds kind of odd and out of place. Well, why couldn't she kiss him outdoors? Why couldn't she, you know, what do we call it? PDAs. Public display of affections. Well, what's wrong with that? They're married, right? They can do that. They want to smooch each other in public and kind of lean on each other and lovey-dovey eyes in public. What's wrong with that? In this culture, you couldn't do that. In this culture, that sort of PDA, we might call it, that was to be private. That is not a public thing to do. What she's saying here, if you were like my brother, if we were just kinfolk, well, then they could act more affectionate as family can in public. You know, if we were literally brothers and sisters, I could be more playful with you in public. I could hold your hand. But as husband and wives, a husband's kissing wives, in that culture, that was a quasi-sexual thing to do. That was not appropriate to do in public, and typically not allowed, is what historians tell us. Married couples were apparently not allowed to hold hands in public either. That was something to be kept in private. So even though they are married, even though they have right to one another's bodies, you might say, and they're not being prudish or anything in that regard, they still had to abide by the cultural expectations of their society. There are still rules of mores and right behavior that they had to live by. Their love is intended to be a very beautiful, intimate, and private joy. And kind of the idea, if you of not displaying too much of your affection out in the public streets, it seems, it's meant for the privacy between the two of you. And so that is a part of their culture, apparently. Verse 3, "His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me." And we've seen this description before. Here it is in marriage. Perhaps before is what her, kind of like she had a wish, and here we see her wish fulfillment. They can embrace. Again, this would not be in public, though. This would be privately as married couple. His right hand embraces me. And here we get this admonition. "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases." Here the wording is a bit different. It's a bit different from what she said before. Here she says, "Do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases." Another way it can be translated, I've seen it translated this way as well, "Stir up love and awaken love when it pleases." In other words, before you're married, it's all don't. After marriage, yes, stir up love when it pleases, when it's the right time. In other words, the message hasn't changed. When the time is right, stir up love when the time is right. And we get this emphasis then, Scripture showing us the right time to stir up love, the sexuality and all, that's to be enjoyed in marriage to please one another. The final verses are very obscure. We're not quite sure what's going on. Verses 5 seems to be, I'm just going to kind of read the meaning here, seems to be a reference that they're going back to their, looking back to how she grew up. It's like connecting back to the introduction now when she was controlled by her brothers, but now she's married. She returns back home, and she is no longer under their control. Verse 6, she's addressing her husband, "Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is as strong as death. And jealousy is cruel as the grave. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame." What she seems to be doing here is that she wants to be indelibly impressed upon his heart and upon his arm. The arm is a symbol of all his actions, everything he does, everything he is, everything he does. She wants him to make her a part of it, ever be together. And then she makes this comment, still in verse 6, "For love is as strong as death, jealousy as cruel as grave." Love can be jealous. "Its flames, flames of love, or flames of fire, most vehement flame." That last line, vehement flame, can also be translated as the flame of Yah. Yah meaning God. Here we have a rather somewhat, depending on how it's translated, a rather direct mention of God. Jealousy and love, flames are flames of fire, are most like the flame of Yah. We get this idea that true love is a jealous love. And of course, we recognize that God is a jealous God. God loves his people. He loves his church. And he is very protective. And he hates idolatry. He hates adultery. He wants marriages to succeed and be one and forever. "Many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it. If a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised." Nothing is more valuable than love. Verse 8 through 9 seems to be the brothers, or maybe just other people, saying, "Well, we have a little sister, and she has no breast." So this is a very much an adolescent girl. "What shall we do for our sister in the day when she is spoken of?" So maybe we're sitting up here, and it's kind of obscure again. It's as if a question, well, what do we do? We have there's a little girl, a little sister in our family. What do we do for her? And how do we take care of her until the time of her, for her to be married? Verse 9, and the translation is really poor, and they're just really not sure what it's all about. "If she is a wall, we will build upon her a battlement of silver." Well, the metaphor is really weird. How can a little girl be a wall and a battlement building fortifying features upon her? That is just pretty obscure to our culture. It seems to be the idea that if she is protected, if we're going to protect her, then we'll protect her and help her to be very beautiful. Kind of like what happened to the Shulamite. Her brothers protected her virginity, protected her reputation. "And if she is a door, we will enclose her or confine her with boards of cedar." That is also very obscure. I'm not sure what it's really suggesting. Scholars are kind of befuddled by that too. The idea is if she's the door, we'll enclose her. We're going to keep her locked up. We're going to keep her protected. John, you got a comment?
I was going to ask, could this be like whether she's promiscuous or like tends to be that way or not?
It seems to be conveying this idea that the brothers, the men in her family, out of love for their sister, to protect her for her future happiness in marriage, they're going to do what they can to protect her. In essence, it's for her own good, seems to be. In that society, the men, the dads were expected to protect their daughters. And the brothers had a responsibility in that too. They would protect their sisters to make sure that no harm would come to her. They lived in a society when men were very overbearing. Men raped women. Okay, it wasn't Walt Disney World back then. All sugar and sweet and nice. So the brothers had a responsibility to do what they could to protect her. That's what families do. That's what families should do. And so it's kind of obscure, but it gives this idea, again, the brothers are part, ever since she's a little girl, they're a part of protecting their sister, protecting her virginity, protecting her purity, protecting her her chastity, her reputation. And of course, in the same time, we might say they're protecting the family's reputation as well, that no shame would come to the family. And then the Shulamite says, I am a wall or protected. It could be a past tense verb that am is added because the verb isn't clear. It could be, I was protected. I was a wall. She said, my breast like towers. Some suggesting maybe as a young girl, she grew into maturity as a young woman, and she was still guarded, protected. Then I became in his eyes, the eyes of her beloved, as the one who found peace, as the one who found rest or shalom, peace. What we might say is she was guarded as a young girl by her brothers, her family, and then when the time was right, her lover, through terms of peace and love, was allowed entrance into the fortress, into the protection, into her life. Marriage, there's no need for the brothers to guard her chastity anymore. They're no longer responsible for protecting her anymore. She's married. That's her husband's responsibility to protect his wife. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Haman. He leased the vineyard to keepers. Everyone was to bring for its fruit 1,000 silver coins. Seems to be a literal reference to Solomon, or it could refer to the nameless groom. My own vineyard is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000. Those who tend its fruit, 200. We're not sure what it means. It's all obscure. Perhaps reference to bridal gifts or something. You who dwell in the gardens, this is apparently the man speaking here. You who dwell in the gardens, the companions listened for your voice. Let me hear it. This may mean all attention is on his bride, his wife, but he's reminding her and others that their call for intimacy is only for them now. It's only for he and her to know as husband and wife. And so you might get the sense that the wall is now built around him and his wife. They are not guarded. They are off limits to other people in their relationship, in that sense of their relationship. Make haste, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. The woman speaking here, and he says, call for me when you want me, and she is definitely calling to him. And so what we get, she's saying, hurry, come, let's share more of that special delight of marriage. Intimacy is to be guarded and unique in marriage, and we get the sense here as it ends with this call for, let's go back again to the mountains of spices. We get this idea that this beautiful relationship is going to continue on. And there you have it, as we understand it. Do we understand everything about this book? No. But what I've given you again is a rather more conservative view of this. I think it makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of room for clarity we don't know yet. Okay, so we're going to do these reports in sequential order, and I'll just read off the list and you kind of get a sense. Sam, you get to go first. Yeah, isn't that great? You get to set the standard because you have Proverbs in chapter 11, so you're one of the earliest ones. So after Sam today, then it'll be Monique, then Ariana, then Micah, then Kima, and then Bradley. Okay, so that's how the order will do it. So let's go ahead and we'll have Sam start first.
Hi, guys. So I picked Proverbs 11 because Mr. Oehler said we couldn't do the first 10 chapters because that's what we covered in class. So I just started reading in 11, and this is the first one I liked because it's 11, 12, 13. and then the more I read it, I was like, yeah, this actually really applies to me. So I'm glad I picked it. As you can see, it says, he who is devoid of wisdom despises his neighbor, but a man of understanding holds his peace. A talebearer reveals secrets, but he who is of a faithful spirit conceals a matter. So there's not really any figurative language in it, and it wouldn't like mean anything special to anyone back then, like more than it means to us today, because it's like pretty relevant across all of time. But a concealing up there, that doesn't mean you like are deviously hiding things. It just means that you're like, you don't go around spreading everyone's secrets, which is a really good thing to not do. It emphasizes the wisdom of guarding your tongue and keeping your mouth shut, which is something that I need to work on sometimes because I tend to talk a lot without thinking. I like the New Living Translation of it because it says, it's foolish to belittle one's neighbor. A sensible person keeps quiet. When you're like dragging people down all the time, that reflects very poorly on you and your self-confidence and also just like how you think about people. And you should probably change your thought patterns if that's how you talk a lot. And it also says, a gossip goes around telling secrets, but those who are trustworthy can keep a confidence. That is more like relationship advice to me, where it's like, I want people to trust me. And so if you want to have like a deeper relationship with someone where you're at the level where they're willing to share things with you, like they have to trust that you're not going to go around telling everybody. This is wisdom because it reminds you to think before you speak, and it helps to protect your reputation by not like speaking negatively about people all the time, because that if you speak words of like life and wisdom and love, then people are going to respect you more than if you're constantly spewing negativity. It helps you to become a more useful, helpful person in relationships because people are willing to share things with you and to talk things over with you. And it helps you to appeal to everyone and to like make them feel loved and appreciated. And that's what I like about this.
Okay, so Proverbs 15, verse 1 to 2 reads, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue of the wise uses knowledge rightly, but the mouth of fools pours forth foolishness. So I chose this proverb because it reminded me of a teaching my mom always tried to instill in us as children whenever we fought or spoke strongly to one another. She always reminded us that it's not only the words that we use, but the tone of our voices when expressing these words. Wisdom shows us the value of a soft answer, and this is the kind of answer that can literally turn away wrath. This is such an important and powerful tool that we can learn and apply in our everyday conversations and everyday life. In Romans 12, verse 17, it says, repay no one evil for evil. And in Romans 12, verse 20, it says, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. I think this links really nicely with the proverb in that it's more powerful to love than to hate. So the simple act of using wisdom and knowledge to know the correct tone of voice, as well as using a combination of words that create a soft answer, could quieten the wrath in the person's heart and encourage him or her to do the same. So we should always seek to be the example in every situation. In line two, but harsh words stir up anger, it's almost the other side of the coin. And this is a antithetical parallelism. And it's used to emphasize the meaning. This would just be reacting quickly and reciprocating the anger and not thinking and using wisdom and knowledge to respond with a soft answer. So basically, respond, don't react, which is something I heard from Logan, actually. This phrase helps you in everyday situations, and it's something that's easy to remember when you're in these difficult situations. So respond and don't just react. Verse 2 emphasizes the point further by basically repeating verse 1, which is synonymous parallelism. So the tongue of the wise uses knowledge rightly, but the mouth of fools pours forth foolishness. Therefore, we can see how important wisdom is when we converse with others in our everyday lives, and in order to convey the correct message and to turn away wrath and anger. So other translations, the NIV says a gentle answer, and the New Living Translation says harsh words make tempers flare. And I think these different analogies help us to understand the proverb better. So thank you.
So mine was Proverbs 16:3, commit your works to the Lord and your thoughts will be established. The New International Version says it's very similar, commit to the Lord whatever you do and he will establish your plans. There's not a lot of figurative language in this, so I think for the most part it means a lot of the same things now that it would have back then, except that in like the Hebrew words for some of these words give a little bit more explanation that kind of make the proverb seem a little deeper. So the Hebrew word for commit is Strong's 1556, and it literally means to roll, commit, remove, run down, seek occasion, trust, or wallow. So roll might seem kind of weird to be translated commit, but like rolling your works conveys a sense of physical action on your part. Like you're not just telling God, this is what I want to do. You're literally rolling this heavy weight of what you're planning to do or your plans or your thoughts over to him and leaving it there. So it connotes the exertion of moving like a heavy stone to a specified place, which takes effort. And then the word for works here is Strong's 62:13, and it can just mean deeds, labors, undertaking, or pursuits, which we'll touch on in a minute. Now for the third part, and your plans will be established. The word for established here is Strong's 3559, which it can mean like to set up or to be fixed, but it can also mean to be made perfect or to be prepared. So basically, like rolling your own plans away from you and into God's hands makes them more concrete, because when God gives them back to you, they'll either be like A, God approved and have his like stamp of approval, or B, they'll be made perfect and he'll modify them for you or show you a totally different way that makes your plans much more part of his will. So in a practical sense, I think this means like abandoning your own ideas and putting them completely into God's hands and keeping your eyes open to the modifications he might be making for them. The Amplified Version says that you have to respond to his will and guidance for your plans to be established. So I guess you need to make sure like you're listening to, I guess, what he's trying to tell you. So at the end of the day, God helps those who help themselves. Like, don't wait for God to make the plan. The verse still talks about committing your pursuits, so that shows that you're pursuing something and that you have your own endeavors and plans and ambitions and goals, which is really good, and then taking those things and giving them to God helps get kind of a sense of God, like, approving your plans and blessing them, because we all know, like, when we try to do things and we don't pray about it, or God is just shutting us down and we keep trying to do them, it just never works out. So I think this proverb is telling us not to rely like on our own reasoning, but to rely on God's wisdom to show us the best way to go.
So I chose Proverbs 17:10, which says, "Rebuke is more effective for a wise man than 100 blows on a fool." I love this because in the world you're going to deal with a lot of fools, and it can get frustrating sometimes. So any advice on dealing with that is helpful. I like the New Living Translation a lot. It says, "A single rebuke does more for a person of understanding than 100 lashes on the back of a fool." So that kind of makes a distinction too, where a wise man is kind of placed to be a man of understanding. So that is kind of a similarity there, but a different way of looking at it. And then the New American Standard Version is really cool too. It says, "A rebuke goes deeper into one who has understanding than 100 blows into a fool." Which kind of puts some imagery on it as well, just because if you get hit 100 times, it's going to be a deep wound, you know? Like, it's not going to heal very easily. But even this says one rebuke goes deeper than that 100 lashes or 100 blows. And then the Micah Standard Version says, "A wise man is easily corrected, but it takes a lot to correct an idiot." And we know the wisdom is fear of the Lord. The beginning of wisdom is fear of the Lord. So then the opposite of that, to be a fool, would be to not fear the Lord. But if you look at the Hebrew word here, it's kasil, and it literally means stupid fellow, dullard, or fool. So it could mean someone who doesn't have understanding, but it could also mean just someone who is stupid. And you're going to deal with people like that, and it can be really frustrating. The other word I'd like to point out is the word affects, which is tahat, and it's Strong's 5181. And it means to sink, descend, to press, or to lead down. I really like that connotation of lead down, meaning changing direction. So you might be, if you're a wise man, one exhortation or one rebuke is enough to lead you down to or change your path to correct you. But it takes a lot more to lead down a fool or to humble them or get them to change direction. And in Hebrews 12:5, I'm going to read that from the New King James Version. It says, actually, I think he's quoting Proverbs here. It says, "And you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him." So to me, I can look at this verse in two ways. I can say, all right, this is practical advice when dealing with someone that just isn't getting it. Maybe don't waste your breath. Or maybe go into it realizing this is going to take a lot more work because this person doesn't have understanding or this person's not in the right mindset to hear. You can take it that way. Or you can also take it as an admonition to then say, all right, well, I'd like to be a wise man, so what do I have to do? I have to take correction and change with that. So don't be like the fool that needs 100 lashes in order to change direction or get things right. Be like the wise man and take correction. So that's the wisdom I got from this.
So the proverb that I chose was Proverbs 22:6, which reads in the New King James Translation, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." Other translations that differ somewhat to this version is the Message Bible Translation, which explains it in a bit of a different way. "Point your kids in the right direction, so when they're old, they won't be lost." Another version, the New Century Version, says, "Train children how to live right, and when they're old, they won't change." At first, this proverb seems like a God-given promise to guarantee Christian parents that if they put in enough hard work and dedication to raising children with a godly upbringing, that they will undoubtedly stay in the church and in the faith, which does have some validity, except it's slightly misguided. The interpretation that this verse is a spiritual promise from God has led to much guilt, grief, and self-condemnation by parents whose offspring has left the church, as they feel responsible and that they just didn't put in enough effort. Everyone has a free choice in the world, as Adam and Eve did with the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and parents can't force their children to choose righteousness, and they have to choose it for themselves. Proverbs 22:6 doesn't guarantee a child's future choices, but it gives a very important emphasis to the spiritual education and proactive godly behavior a parent must pass on to their child to ensure they are fully aware of all the goodness and happiness that God has to offer, so that their chances of sticking with God for the long haul is as likely as possible. The beginning phrase, "to train up a child in the way he should go," harkens back to Genesis 18:19, where Abraham directs his children to the way of God and speaks to the fact that it's the duty of parents to be dedicated to teaching children to live moral and godly lives. Train, which in Hebrew means hanak, which is to dedicate, as seen in several verses such as 1 Kings 8:63 and 2 Chronicles 7:5, which talks about people dedicating themselves or sacrifice to the house of God. This shows that children must receive devoted practice and correction by parents to help lead them to wisdom. With this dedication in mind, training should involve more than instruction, but imitating Christ and living out a godly lifestyle to set them a good example. The last part of the scripture, which is read, "When he is old, he will not depart from it," showcases that generally the impressions of a sound and dedicated teaching on a child does not wear off easily into adulthood and will be with them for the rest of their lives. Therefore, this proverb is not an absolute guarantee that a child will stay in the church, but emphasizes the importance of raising a child correctly and setting a good example to give them the best chance of keeping close to God in the future and staying devoted to his way of life.
My proverb is 27:6. New King James Version reads, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful." The alternate translations are, NIV, "Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses." I like this one because it emphasizes the overbearing flattery of your enemies. In the New Living Version, "Wounds from a sincere friend are better than many kisses from an enemy." So the obvious and utter meaning of this proverb is that if you have friends, you can insult them and degrade them as much as you like, as per the friendship contract. Thank you. No, the real meanings, of which there are several, is that they are applicable to both people of Solomon's time and to us today, are the following. First, this is how we should treat people who offend us. We need to be slow to take offense. When one of our friends says or does something that offends us, we shouldn't assume that they are doing so deliberately or out of malice. The ones we love can hurt us. but we should be quick to forgive and be willing to take wise correction. So, secondly, we should use this proverb in how we ourselves proactively treat others. Sometimes, and this is sometimes, stark honesty is the best solution. Sometimes being roundabout and overly sensitive kills the message. It's not that we should think highly of ourselves and our own opinions. And it's not that we should dispose of gentleness just because it's convenient. But sometimes the truth, that is, the correct answer, but will get us to being more godly, us and them, will be uncomfortable and painful to them and to us. And thirdly, here's a bonus meaning. We shouldn't seek the rewards of the world, the kisses of our enemy, because approval, among other things, is tempting and can lead us along the incorrect path. So, this proverb, in a few words, is valuable advice in our personal relations, as a number of proverbs are. Thank you.
Any of you have any broad comments from what you heard today? What's the audience? What was your response to what you heard today? Any comments? Encouragements? Anybody? Yeah, Sam?
Just like people expounding on those scriptures made me kind of realize like how much depth there is to all of them, and I kind of want like people just go through verse by verse and just talk about all of them, because even like with those couple ones, like I feel like I learned a lot.
Yeah, you understand why it's hard for me not to do that when we're covering this, and it's hard for any of your teachers that are talking to you from scripture not to do that, because God's word is deep. It's not a little pool of water you splash in, although you can, but if you really start getting into it, it's very, very deep. In fact, in some ways there's no bottom to it, is there? Yeah, very good. Any other comments for today's speakers? Now that you need to pinpoint anybody, I'm not asking for evaluations, but just general comments. What did you learn today or gain today?
First off, I enjoyed them all. I thought they were, and if you're reading through Proverbs, you just kind of skimming through it, and sometimes it's good to just sit on one and delve deep. But it seems like they all have to do with being teachable. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like taking rebuke, or, you know, listening to your parents, or, you know, setting your ways to God. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's like the fear of the Lord comes with humility, mm-hmm. like not seeing yourself as somebody who's like infallible, and you can take rebuke and teaching. So I felt like that was kind of a common theme through all of them today.
Very good. Good comment. Yeah. This goes back to the Proverbs are supposed to be, the intent of the Proverbs is to give us some real life applications, some things that we can actually apply in life in all our relationships and in our relationships with God too. So, who knew you could learn so much in 3 minutes, right? I'm really pleased. I always love this part of this assignment, of this class, because then I get to hear from you, and your analysis is very good. It sounds like you know to go back to word meanings. And you're going to Scripture. It's part of that exegesis. You're going to what the Word says and applying your thoughts, other Scriptures, making some comparing with other scriptures, that's fine. I didn't require that, but it's kind of hard not to read a scripture without me having a thought it connects over here to something too. So that's really good. Okay, otherwise we'll get the rest of you tomorrow. Should be a fun day.